Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM, Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. If you are asked to picture what a modern commercial farmer looks like, what do you see? Perhaps you may imagine a white guy with his face reddened and skin lined by years of planting, tilling, harvesting crops to make a living. That would not be inaccurate, but there are also modern commercial black farmers in America doing the same kind of work. They are a smaller but significant part of this country's agricultural history and industry. But there are issues facing black farmers today, issues that have existed for decades. We're talking about debt relief for black farmers who are really struggling to stay afloat. Tonight, you'll hear about the issues and the struggles and why they're not happy with the White House and Capitol Hill lawmakers. My guest is John Boyd, founder and president of the National Black Farmers Association. Now, this is a pre-recorded edition of the Insight segment, so we're not taking your phone calls tonight, but you can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or follow me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Mr. Boyd, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me, and thank the station for following our work for a very, very long time.
Absolutely. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I first heard about this issue quite some years ago when a former reporter was handling this issue quite a bit, and I am perhaps a little surprised that we are still trying to address the issue of debt relief for black farmers in America. Kind of lay that situation out and where black farmers are right now.
Well, basically, this has been nearly four-decade campaign where black farmers were discriminated against, way before that, but we brought it to the forefront in the 80s, and it peaked out in the 90s through protest, and it took my muse to Washington, struggle in 40 acres, and 2010, I bought my tractor, drove my tractor to Washington, named it Justice. So a very, very long fight to raise the issues of discrimination that black farmers were facing at the United States Department of Agriculture and the banking system and the corporations who've been mistreating us for a very, very long time. At the turn of the century, black farmers were 1 million black farm families strong here in the United States, tilling about 20 million acres of land. And today we're down to about 4 million acres of land and about 50,000 full-time farmers, a host of part-time farmers. So we lost a lot of our land. We lost a lot of our legacy and history and way of life. You can talk to any black person in this country, and they will tell you that, somebody was from somebody's farm, and primarily from the southeastern corridor of the United States, and we were slaves, and we went on to be sharecroppers, and fought the horrific laws of Jim Crow. And we're still here after all of that. So we had a long uphill battle. And through the course of the past 30 years, we had two settlements with the United States Department of Agriculture for black farmers. And we never got the injunctive relief. But the injunctive relief was debt relief and also the land out of federal inventory. Black farmers didn't get it, although we won two settlements with USDA. White farmers in this country were receiving debt relief with ease, and I want the listeners to understand with ease. The whole time I've been asking for debt relief for black farmers, white farmers basically got all of the debt relief in this country, and black farmers didn't. And then about a year or so ago, we finally got some sort of vindication where 14,000 plus black and other farmers of color were going to receive debt relief at 120%, 100% loan forgiveness, and 20% to be paid for taxes. And I thought this was a huge step in the right direction for the administration, the Biden administration, and a huge win for blacks, because those were the actual farmers, the guys who had the loans, who have land and would get debt relief, and would give them the abilities to start over in the farming operation. But instead, immediately after that, white farmers started to sue us in 12 different complaints in federal court around the country. And they won on two temporary injunctions in Florida and Texas that prevented the debt relief from being provided to black and other farmers of color. And as you may have heard recently, the Biden administration walked back on that commitment for debt relief and gave us the watered-down version of language for farmers of distress, is what they call it now, and some sort of discrimination fund that would entail everybody, not just black farmers and farmers of color, but anybody, white women, gay and lesbian community, anybody could take part in the discrimination fund. And the farmers of distress, we're competing with 96% of other farmers. So it's going to be a huge fight uphill, and we see it as the administration going back on its word, only similar to 40 acres and a mule, for those who study history. The blacks never got the 40 acres and a mule. We were promised it. We didn't get it. And this is another clear example of that. You know, we were promised $5 billion in debt relief. We did not get it, and we still do not get it. But I also want to note, when payments go out to white farmers in any form of subsidy, once that bill is passed Congress and signed into law by the president, it's in the mailbox of white farmers within days of it passing. And when things pass that pertain to black and other farmers of color, the Secretary of Agriculture, in this case, Tom Vilsack, says he has to come up with some sort of program to get the monies out. And it's always a weight game for blacks in this country. And we also have to keep reinventing ourselves as far as proving our case of discrimination time and time again, when it's been proven in federal court and in a host of congressional hearings and a host of studies. All have said that blacks were dogged in this country, black farmers were dogged and treated brutally by the United States Department of Agriculture. The very same government who's supposed to be giving the hand up to farmers was the very same government that was putting us out of business.
I am talking to John Boyd Jr. He is the founder and president of the National Black Farmers Association. And we're talking about the plight of black farmers in America. We are not taking any phone calls tonight, but if you have any comments about this conversation, you're certainly welcome to tweet me at HFisherWHUR or follow me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Mr. Boyd, as you know, I am not a farmer, but one of the things that strikes me from what you've already shared is that we are very familiar with the discrimination against people of color when it comes to obtaining loans of any kind. Because a lot of times black people had to go to a bank and they would have to sit in front of a loan officer, and that loan officer could see the color of our skin. But, you know, now in 2021, and help me with this, how now might the federal government know that you are a black farmer when debt relief has been issued to, you know, white farmers? How can they not just lump all farmers together? Explain that to me.
A couple things.
Sure.
In the late 80s, my first campaign was to get the word Negro off the federal application at USDA, and we finally got that done.
Mm-hmm.
But they still identify loans at USDA by race. So you check one of the boxes. You say, I'm black, or I'm white, or I'm other, but you still check the box. So USDA knows whether you're black or white or any other ethnicity in this country. But to your point where you talked about the lenders,
mm-hmm.
I want the listening audience to understand how bad blacks were treated in this country. In my home county, Mecklenburg County, Virginia, the county supervisor, that's the person who was responsible for making farm loans at USDA. And it was called the Farmers Home Administration back then. And they changed their name in the 90s to Farm Service Agency. So they changed their name, but they didn't change the way that they greeted and treated black farmers in this country. That person would only see black farmers on Wednesday, one day of the week. And we would all be in the hallway. We all knew each other. And we just didn't talk about it, you know, because of old black pride.
Mm-hmm.
White farmers got farm operating loans in 30 days, and it took 387 days on average to process a black farm loan request. That's the wide disparate figures that we were faced with. And black farmers had to get supervised bank accounts. That means that the county supervisor would have to sign our checks, almost like we were
children.
Wasn't able to even count and add and subtract. And so white farmers got a check, and they deposited and used those funds that they saw fit. Black farmers had a supervised bank account. This particular county supervisor spat on me, spit on me if you're from New York City, spat on me if you're in the country. But he spat tobacco juice on my shirt during an exchange, a loan exchange. You know, when USDA years later came out to investigate him, they said, "Did you spat on John Board?" He said, "Yes, I ain't mean to spit on that old boy. I accidentally missed my spat can on the desk. His spat can was on the other end of the desk, and he meant to spat on me. And I didn't have the relationship that I have today with God, so it got very heated in there very quickly. But that's the kind of discrimination that we faced. We were called racial epithets like it was night and day at the USDA board, Negro, or whatever you all call yourselves, is what he said frequently,
mm-hmm.
whatever you people call yourselves. And I'm not going to lend you any of my money, is the terminology that this person spoke to black farmers in that community. I don't know a white farmer's community who's been spat on by the government. I don't know a white farmer who's been called a nigger to his face during a loan exchange. I don't know a white farmer who was restricted to one day a week, and I don't know a white farmer who had a supervised bank account at the United States Department of Agriculture. So when they said they don't treat blacks differently, it's BS, and I'm a living example of what they did to black farmers in this country. So we face brutal, blatant discrimination. I received a finding of discrimination from USDA, where they investigated themselves and said, "You know what, this is so bad, we got to find ourselves guilty." And instead of firing that person, they moved them to another county. And, you know, when Ed Bradley came out on 60 Minutes and interviewed him, he was drunk at the Pork Festival in Emporia, Virginia. And they asked him, he said, "Well, John Board says you sleep during the application process sometimes." He said, "Oh, I'm not sleeping. I'm just snoozing. I can hear what that old boy is saying to me." Old boy. And that's what he referred to mm-hmm. black farmers and that type of racial epithet. So that's the kind of discrimination we face, and it's been going on for decades. I just came along at a time where I was the youngest guy in the bunch, and all those guys in the hallway were senior statesmen to me. They were
mm-hmm.
they were deacons. They were preachers. One or two held local offices. So black farmers always farmed but had a public job, too, to make ends meet, including myself. So we dignified people, and you know, we've been putting up with this stuff for decades. And, you know, fast forward to 2022, we're still doing the same thing where we can't cash in, people. And we're not cashing in because we're black. And I'm going to say it right here on this show. And we need a president that's going to come to the table and address it, you know. I've been a part of the presidential meetings with black leaders for for decades at the White House, and this year I was excluded. I'm being excluded because I'm raising real issues that affect the black community, you know? Mm-hmm. Where's this $5 billion? Why can't we get it? Why did you repeal it and replace it with watered-down language that caused us to compete again and reprove our cases again that these things have already been done?
I'm talking to John Boyd, Jr., founder and president of the National Black Farmers Association. We're talking about the issues surrounding the modern black farmer and debt relief. We're not taking any calls for this special broadcast, but I invite you to give me a tweet at HFisherWHUR, or you can follow me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. You know, one of the things, you know, Mr. Boyd, that, you know, that I've, you know, seen that this originally, as you said, this federal debt relief program had language that, you know, that changed, just as you said. This was for farmers, you know, of color, and then it went to distressed farmers. And yes. And I think that that's one of, and it happened literally within a year or so, because this plan for debt relief was first kind of formulated in 2021, and literally by this summer, things kind of died on the vine. In your discussions with you know, the USDA and the Biden administration, what reasoning have they given? Is it because the, you know, the white farmers gave black farmers, yes, the legal pushback, or do you think there was, you know, there was something else? I mean, this information,
well,
that you,
I think it's a combination of both. And thank you very much for that question. I think it's a combination of both. One, not having the galls and guts and the stand with all to stand and fight and fight for blacks, and in this particular instance, blacks and other farmers of color, Native Americans and Hispanics and Asians, were all able to take part under this measure. And the administration didn't want to go toe-to-toe with, you know, with white farmers who've gotten everything anyway. Mm-hmm. I don't see where we're going to lose anything here by people by fighting. Sometimes you got to stay in the ring and fight and prove your case and win. It may take a little longer. But they caved in. They didn't want to fight. And the president, I'm glad you asked the question, that last year at the White House, said, hey, board, we need to sit down and have a FaceTime meeting in the coming months to see what the administration can do to help get around some of this stuff. So it was the president's ask, you know, to have the meeting, and I said, yes, that desperately needs to happen. And since that time, the meeting hasn't happened. I've gotten a runaround from the White House. And last week, they had a meeting with black leaders, and I was excluded from the meeting, you know, knowing that I want to raise issues that are very important to black farmers and the black community. So with that said, Democratic leadership, my message to Democratic leadership is you have to do what you say you're going to do, and sometimes you have to fight. You know, I was raised by my daddy, John Boyd, Sr.
Well, hold that point, because I do want to hear what you have to say, but I need to take just a brief break. But we want to remind our listeners, don't forget, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast, including this broadcast, on WHUR.com. And you can download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. The Daily Drum will continue on SiriusXM, Channel 141, 96.3 HD2, and 98.3 FM. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. This discussion continues in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're talking about black farmers in America and the issues facing their economic survival. My guest is John Boyd, Jr., founder and president of the National Black Farmers Association. This is a pre-recorded edition of the Inside segment. We're not taking phone calls tonight, but you can tweet me at HFisherWHUR or follow me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Mr. Boyd, before the break, you were talking about the kind of dilemma that you're in, you know, right now with, you know, black leadership, Democratic leadership. And I do remember, yes, just last week, there was a host of civil rights leaders and a high-level activists who were talking to President Biden. They were talking about voter rights. They were talking a lot about the water situation in Jackson, Mississippi. There were also concerns about the false claims of voter fraud. But as you said, you were not part of that group. Please go right ahead with your point.
Yes, and I want the listeners to understand, historically, for decades, I've always been at the table at those meetings. So I think it just raises a question as to why I wasn't at the meeting, and especially when the president committed to a FaceTime meeting. That hasn't happened. And I was saying, you know, when you don't have any money, you know, I was raised with no money, but a very good work ethic. And I want to say this for the listeners. I promise you I can just about outwork any white farmer in this country. So, and I'm not saying that in a boastful way. I'm saying that because we've been painted with the brush that black men and black farmers in this country are lazy. We don't want to work and all of these things. I work 7 days a week. I work hard, but I need the same tools as white farmers in this country. I need loans on time. I need access to credit. I need access to subsidies. All of these things have to be made readily available to me too, and not just for white farmers. So I wanted to comment on that because I've been reading some of the posts out there that you know, blacks don't want to work and they're lazy. And So I challenge any person to come to my farm and spend a day with me, and let's see who sits down first, and let's see who sits down on the job first. So. And I'm not saying that in a very boastful way, but you have to keep your word is what I was trying to say. When the president made the commitment that he was going to have the meeting, you got to do what you say you're going to do, and you got to make those things happen, even when the dialogue can be tough. You still have to live up to your word. And that's something that I was taught to very early by my dad, John Boyd Sr., and my grandfather, Thomas Boyd. Your word is your bond. Your word is everything that you have because you don't have any money. And so the administration went back on its word to have the meeting. And quite frankly, they repealed the language. They can call it whatever they want. But the word that they used in the language is, we have repealed debt relief. So they repealed it. And what that means for people who understand what that is, they took it away. They took away the commitment for $5 billion and replaced it with very watered-down language, distress farmers. That's going to include white farmers. I didn't spend 30 years working on debt relief to get more debt relief for white farmers who've gotten it all in the first doggone place. So I'm very disappointed with the language. I'm very disappointed in Democratic leadership not standing toe-to-toe in fighting for, in this case, for black and other farmers of color. They caved, and that's what happened. You can call it what you want.
I want to talk a little more about your, you know, your work and exactly what the life of a black farmer is like. I will share with you that, you know, as a kid, you know, I went to what we used to call going down home. I'm sure you know that, you know, that phrase where, you know, so many, you know, black families in this country, particularly those who live in, you know, in the North or in the Mid-Atlantic or wherever, you know, they have family in the South, down home. And during the summers, we used to go down with my grandparents to Greenwood, South Carolina, a little place called 96. You know, it's a small town when when the name of the town is a number. And my great-grandfather, John Fisher, had what would probably have been considered at that time a compound, which may have been unusual for black farmers during the early 1900s, all the way up until right now, the family land. And I remember as a kid seeing fields of cotton in the summer that looked like snow.
That's right.
And corn and cows, and they also were growing soybeans. And I remember hearing tales that my grandfather told about his father selling during the early 1900s cotton to the federal government to make uniforms for the doughboys in World War I.
Yes.
And in World War II, which, you know, as a black farmer was an unusual position to be in. And and certainly there was just one tractor that I saw when I was a kid back in the 1970s. But I did have a kind of a rudimentary understanding of what that meant. You know, my great-grandfather, he lived on a farm. My grandfather was born on a farm. My father was born on the farm before coming to Washington, D.C. So I have an understanding of what it was like then. But you have a modern farm, a large farm. Talk to our listeners about, you know, what you grow and your operation.
Yes, and I didn't do that earlier, but I can't do that without giving the thanks and wherewithal from my daddy, John Board Sr., and my grandfather, Thomas Board, and my mother's grandparents, Lee and Ruth Robinson, who were sharecroppers in the southern part of Virginia. But my grandfather and daddy taught me that land is the most powerful tool you can possess. You can either own it. Every step you take, every step you make requires land ownership. You can either be on your own land or you can be trespassing on someone else's. That's the way I was taught. And this man, my grandfather, slept with his deeds underneath his mattress. And he didn't trust the courthouses and government. And he didn't record his deeds until 1972. But he owned the land, bought and paid for the land in 1920s. That's how bad that they didn't trust the government and whites in that particular time period. But today, I own about 1,500 acres of land along the historic Roanoke River in Mecklenburg County. So if you're driving past 85, Interstate 85, traveling south, the last exit there at the Roanoke River, you're looking at my farm and my forefathers' land until that very same soil. And they canoed up the Roanoke River and dated and courted and bartered and mingled. So the river had a sense of relationship to blacks in that community, where the secondary roads weren't safe to travel for blacks as it got dusty dark, but they could always travel the river by canoe. And that's the way my grandfather did back then. But today I own, 1,500 acres, and I grow corn, I grow wheat, I grow soybeans, and about 150 head of beef cattle. So I have a cow-calf operation, and I used to raise, at the beginning of my career in the 80s, I used to raise cotton that you spoke about. I used to raise tobacco and peanuts. Those three commodities were my breadwinners. And today, after the government did buyouts on all three of those commodities, I now transformed into full-grain operation, and I'm competing. I want people to know that, you know, blacks can farm. That's something that we came to the United States with the skill set of farming. So people don't know the real history. We were teaching whites how to grow stuff here as slaves. So it was the blacks who were real farmers in the first place. You know, yes, we were slaves, but we were also farmers in this country.
What is a typical day like, you know, for you when you're working?
It's challenging, and I want the listeners to know that farming is the hardest occupation known to man. The work never stops. I can work all around the clock, and tomorrow I still have something that I didn't do today, you know? But we have fencing. We have everything on the farm breaks down because it takes, brutal action from tractors to disc harrows to planters. So I have to be a part mechanic. I have to know how to do everything and plant on time and harvest on time. There's two basic times that are very, very important to farmers, and that's planting and harvest. So if you don't plant on time, you don't have the maximum harvest. And if you don't get your combines in the field, you don't get the maximum harvest. And I would like to tie in here the problems that we've had with companies like John Deere, who won't service black farmers on time, but they service large-scale white farmers within hours of the call. We have to wait until a service technician comes out and fix our equipment. So we catch hell on every avenue here. And I want people to know that it's not easy, but I'm out here every day. And I'm out here because I love it. And I'm a generational farmer. And I love the smell of the land. I love everything about farming. I don't love the way I'm treated by and received by these companies and the government. But I love to farm. I love to see the crop come out the ground. I love to see it grow. And I'm a very proud farmer and dignified farmer. I want my crops to look good. I want them to reflect the farmer that I am. So I'm very competitive there. And, my day starts at 5 a.m., whether I'm sitting down having a cup of coffee, and the first thing I do is I watch the weather. I want to see if it's going to rain, it's going to be hot or cold or whatever. And I kind of take my day from there. But the work, all of it has, it's very labor intense. So if you hear people who say, hey, I want to be a farmer, get ready to work. You have to work. Everything that evolves around the farm contains physical labor. Even with modern day equipment, you have to be able to hook the implements up, unhook them, get them to work, and all of these things. So, I don't want people to think it's easy because it's not. It's very challenging. And all of the things that aspects that we're challenged with can make it even more challenging. I hope I'm explaining that correctly.
Yeah, I do understand. How do you turn profit, and what at this point in your farming career is your most and least profitable product or crop?
Well, I'm experimenting. I'm glad you raised that question. I'm experimenting with hemp, so this is my third year growing hemp. So I'm trying to diversify my farming operation there. So I'm looking into that as a creative avenue. I do support legalized marijuana, and I hope that they pass a national law to do that. But my number one cash crop is soybeans. So that's really my number one cash crop, although I still raise corn and wheat. My number one moneymaker, and you ask me how do I make money and turn a profit, is I have to have a productive soybean crop in order to make it. And this year it looks like I may have one. But you don't know. It looks good in the field, but a farmer never knows until he makes that first round with the combine to see what shows up in his combine bin. So I have to turn a profit there, and it's very competitive and time consuming, and I try to keep my costs low. What I mean by that is I'm not putting out all of the fertilizer that I probably should be, or lime. I'm putting enough out there to make my crop, and these are skill sets that I all learned from. Next year, I'll be celebrating my 40th year as a farmer. I've been farming since 1983. I bought my first farm in 1983 at the age of 18. So I've been farming a very, very long time.
So I want to drill down a little bit more because this is really fascinating to me. So when you talk about, the soybeans. The only thing that I'm good at growing is basil in a pot on my front porch.
You grow something, and I don't want people to think that you can't.
Yeah,
I have to have a good soybean crop, and what I mean by that is each acre has to do as good as the county average or better. in the county average for me to make money. And this year it looks like soybeans will be up because of all of the things that are happening with the world as far as the war and Ukraine and Russia. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a region of the world that's not going to be producing grain there as they would be in the future. So grain is like any other thing in this country, price and demand. I think there's going to be a demand for soybeans. Wheat and corn, those three commodities are in just about everything that you put your hand on in the supermarket.
Absolutely.
Corn, wheat, and soybeans, people. So people say, well, I don't eat soybeans. If you ate at Hardee's and McDonald's, guess what, people? You ate some soybeans because they mix it up with the beef. And wheat, if you ate a loaf of bread, you ate some wheat. And corn, if you ate some corn flakes or any other corn additive product.
Corn syrup, for example.
Corn syrup, everything. They're very three diverse commodities that are used for just about anything. So those are the three major commodities. And they're still the three major commodities that the United States can do just about better than any other region of the world, which is why they call this the corn belt and the corn basket and all these things of the world. It's because we can still produce these things better than anyone.
So when you harvest, let's go back to the soybeans.
Yes.
When do you harvest them, and how long does that take for you? And at what and to whom do you sell the soybeans?
Great questions. Yeah. Great questions. Harvest season for me. And don't laugh, listen, that means a happy check for me. I get paid.
Mm-hmm.
October is harvest time for me for soybeans. So about the first week of October, and I have two massive combines that run through the field. They have 20-foot and 25-feet headers, so you can make a swipe out of a field with 20 feet on each machine. So you can make a little time, but your machine has to be in good shape. And I do have two combines. I have trucks and trailers that hold 1,000 bushels. And I sell to two grain elevators, one in Petersburg, Virginia, and one in Raleigh, depending on who has the best price. So I drive an hour in each direction to get to the grain elevator. So you have to have your own equipment. And like I said earlier, you've got to be able to work on this equipment. If not, you just won't turn a profit because everybody that comes to your farm wants to charge you an extremely high rate, a billing hour rate to work on this equipment. So it's a challenging field, and you have to be very savvy, watch the markets, and understand the game that you're in.
Are you still raising cattle?
Yes, I have 150 head of beef cattle. So I have what's called a cow-calf operation. So I have some bulls in there, I have two bulls. And they mate the females, and they drop a calf once a year. And those calves, I top them out at about 400 to 500 pounds. And then I sell them to local markets. One is in Blackstone, Virginia, and the other is in Lynchburg, Virginia. And sometimes I sell to some friends who want to, start a calf for meat for their family and things of that nature.
Talk to me about some of the things that I've been seeing, hearing. We hear a lot about farm to table as it relates to restaurants. We know that school districts in every state have programs that are farm to school districts. And I also see you see some roadside stands as you drive in, some of the,
the
rural.
I would like to explain that.
Yeah, so talk to me about all of that.
I would like to explain that because anytime, and most of the public immediately tags us with that type of farming operation. That type of farming can be done in conjunction with a three commodity farm. In order to help add monies to your bottom line to pay your mortgages. But that type of farming, a vegetable stand, is not going to pay a mortgage on 1,500 acres. So, mm-hmm. So there's different stages of farming that you can do. There's a small-scale farmer, that I could have a vegetable stand and a few contracts and make it like that. But for people who have equipment loans, like I do, and mortgages like I do, those vegetable type operation would have to be done in conjunction with a cow-calf operation and at least one of the major commodities that you will have a sizable check. I'm hoping I'm describing that.
Mm-hmm.
To make those mortgage payments at the end of the year. So for people that are listening, we need real resources to make it and to maintain and buy land and all of these things, just the way that the other farmers do. And I'm not belittling farmers markets or anything like that. I want people to understand the difference between that type of agriculture and a production, a farming operation. So there's really two types of farming there on that aspect. And what we could do to better that is to form more relations with the black church, you know, where they could adopt a farmer, a black farmer in that community, and, you know, sell his produce at the church on Sunday. You know, blacks come out and buy us tomatoes and cucumbers and corn, sweet corn and stuff like that. I want to see more of that. And there was an article that came out in the Black Star where I went into depth about how we lost our communities because that's what blacks were made on in the United States. We had relations with each other, and we bought food, and we bartered and trade, and we bought food from each other, and we've gotten away from that. And we're going to have to reinvent that in order to make farming and agriculture again, popular in our community. We have to stop teaching our children that farming is bad. And everybody talk to black persons, oh my God, I never want to go back to the farm. It was such hard work. Don't tell your kids that. Tell them that farming and the ability to feed yourselves is a very powerful tool. The ability to own land and what comes with that is a very powerful tool. You can build a home on it. You don't have to be a full-time farmer. But everybody needs land. It's something that, you know, God doesn't make any more of, you know. Stop buying these raggedy cars that don't mean anything. And stop buying all these clothes that don't mean anything. They're going to get old in the next trend. Invest in land ownership. That's a tool that we can do amongst ourselves without the government's permission. There's a for sale sign in your community. If you don't have enough, team up with another business person or another family member. But buy the land if it's readily available in your community. And that's my message today. We don't have to wait for the government to help us. And we're not getting enough support from the National Black Farmers Association from prominent blacks in this country. There hasn't been a donation from Oprah Winfrey or some of the athletes, the conglomerates and athletes, or LeBron James. I mean, people that I like, I enjoy watching them. But they haven't given back to the oldest occupation in the history for black people in this country and this farming. And they can go out to the National Black Farmers Association website and help us. We don't have to wait for the government to toll these payments out when we can start helping ourselves.
Mm.
And we're just not seeing that from the black community.
If you have an opportunity to have that face-to-face a conversation with, you know, President Biden, or any of the federal lawmakers,
yes.
What's your message to them?
The first sentence would be, "You got to get up. You got to get your foot off our neck." That's the first sentence. You got to get your foot off our neck so we can breathe and make it out here in this country. And what I mean by that is, you have to make federal programs readily available for blacks in this country. You can't just say it's there, but you got to do it with leadership. It has to be a process where all Americans can see what's going on with our farm lending in this country, where blacks aren't getting the loans. We aren't getting the access to credit at Fortune 500 companies. We aren't getting the bank loans. By the president saying, do more business with black farmers from the microphone, I think it would add a whole lot of weight to corporate America and the United States Department of Agriculture rather than repealing debt relief. I think it was the wrong thing at this particular wrong time in history, people, to not stand and fight. Every time you tuck and roll, I mean, what does that say to the black in this case, the black farmers. So we're not important enough to fight. We don't get the money again. We don't get the land again. We don't get the 40 acres and the mule again. It's just history repeating itself. Yeah. So my first sentence would be, get your foot off our neck. Take the national and world platform that you have and say, help black farmers in this country. Help black farmers the same way you help Ukraine farmers in this country. By giving them $250 million for infrastructure to buy equipment, to buy seed, fertilizer, and maintain their farms. That's the same thing I've been asking in America for almost four decades, and we haven't gotten. So how do you think we feel to watch this type of when you help them, they call it aid. When they help us, they want to name it charity.
Yeah.
I don't give a rat's behind if you call it aid or charity. Do what you've been doing for these white farmers or anybody that looks white. Do it for black farmers in this country. Mm. That's what I'm saying, people.
Mm. Well, John Boyd, I'm going to have that be the last word. But I really appreciate your time. I've learned quite a bit. And I want to thank you for your time and
wish you the best of luck.
And keep us updated on any meetings or any movement that you may see in helping black farmers in America.
Absolutely. And I would like to thank you for taking time to bring this very, very important issue to our people. And people, go out and support the National Black Farmers Association. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. That is The Daily Drum on SiriusXM Channel 141 for this Friday, September 16th. For News Director Renee Nash, reporters Millette Green, Bramante Bryan, producer Candace Atkins-Wilson, and engineer Bobby Adams, I'm Harold Fisher. Good night, and have a wonderful weekend.